I'm really pleased to be able to welcome John, Sir John Battle, to our session this afternoon. And welcome to John and Mary, who are joining us for the day. And he's got a very hectic schedule, and he's really kindly given his time to us. So John is a patron, a wonderful supporter and great friend of the National Justice and Peace Network. And he has Catholic social teaching and Catholic action running through his veins. He speaks of theopraxis, but we thought if we put that in the programme, people would think, what's that? Anyway, it's faith and action. I'm not going to go through his biography and his CV because it's in the conference booklet and he told me to keep it short. So he's going to speak to us about the challenges for all of us, and the title of his talk is Advocacy as Faith Action. And we hear and read about the vicious language and misleading information that we are being fed all the time, and it's insidious advertising. So John is going to speak about advocacy as faith action, and he's going to speak, and then there will be a question and answer session at the end of his talk, and he's going to manage that himself, which is fantastic. So welcome to John.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks for inviting me. I was looking at the poster behind us, Sustainability, Survival or Shutdown. And in some ways, I want to apply those words to the NJPN. And in memory of Brian, actually, Brian was one of the first founders of JP and Network in the late 70s. And that was a time of rising unemployment in our communities, not least mine in Leeds. It was the time of the Northern Ireland conflict, and it was the time of the threat of the nuclear weapons build-up. And I think, and I'll speak today of some of the challenges we face, and I think our network is needed more than ever before. We have to think out our role, but we need to build our support within this network. Now's the time, and perhaps now is the time to do it, in Brian's memory. Anne asked me to say a few words about advocacy. I stepped back from representational politics after some 12 years ago, having had the great privilege of representing an inner city Leeds area, Leeds West, where we still live. And now most of my time is spent with communities in our neighbourhood, not least the Armley-Wortley community, a community still under the pressures of what we might call the original sin of austerity, of cutbacks, part-time, temporary, low-paid work at best, dependent on overwhelmed food banks now. And yes, yesterday in the community centre, the conversation sparked around the lies about inflation falling. It was quite interesting. As Maggie said, the papers and the news are claiming it means the food bills are coming down. Well, they're not. Don't media people know what inflation really is? Our supermarket prices are still rising at 17%. And Maggie added, and we're still paying the price. I was reminded by Maggie of a meeting when I was a Member of Parliament. There was a panel, and the issue was benefits and taxes. And one of my colleagues, not of the same party, but one of my colleagues, one of the MPs, commented that tax and benefits is so complicated, it's best not to bother with it because we've to leave it to the experts. It's not for ordinary people and MPs. And a woman stood up and she said, look, those of us who pay the price can do the arithmetic. Why on earth can't you? And that's the challenge across a whole range of things where we've been given simplistic misinformation and slogans. The conversation yesterday then shifted. Someone at one of the tables in the coffee said, started an argument about cars. Two-thirds of the people in that community don't have a car, but we started because of the by-elections discussing the impact of the car on our environment. And one person commented, in one of the schools nearby, on one of the arterial roads, we're in a kind of a circle where the roads go into the middle. In one of the arterial roads, we have the highest incidence of NOx pollution on children's brains in the country. And she said, are we in favour of cars? We're more worried that the bus timetable's been cut next week and we won't be able to get into town at all. I still pay attention to politics, And perhaps I'd like to say a few words about what I'd call the fast-changing political culture. And I thought I'd do it by, on the way down to the conference today, I called in for a cup of coffee, and I picked up a sample of this morning's newspapers to see what they were making of the by-election. And if you'll forgive me, I'll flash a few headlines at you. I've got the lot. Forgive me for my purchases. You know, it is the full round show. My addiction to keeping up with the news. Go true blue or face wipeout. But inside, you les or you lose. What does that mean? There's a lovely piece further on called Climate Hysteria. There it is. Two pages saying, don't worry about 40, 50 degrees of temperature. It wasn't that long ago, it says. When the Thames froze over, forget it. The Times. The Mail. I'll tell you the paper. Don't laugh, they're all the same. It gets slightly worse. The Times. Revolt over green costs. Show the Tories a hint of the way ahead. And the editorial in the Times. Sunak aims to divide and rule after the setbacks. To make the division over green policies the dividing line in the next election. You're either for cars or you're against. It's as simple as that. The Daily Telegraph is even stronger. PM urged by Cabinet to abandon eco policy entirely. The editorial, cars are not a luxury. Arrogant schemes to push people onto bikes, buses and trains should be stopped. Schemes being rolled out across the country are now provoking unrest. Labour councils are trying to ban driving entirely and our freedom to drive. Defending the liberty of drivers should now be a priority. The same holds for the action under the banner of net zero. That 2030 deadline for scrapping petrol and diesel cars needs to go. There will be huge political benefits to scrapping these pointless punitive measures. A determined effort to exploit more gas and oil reserves will prove popular as it will lead to falling energy bills. When David Cameron ordered his ministers to cut the green crap, he obviously won an election. So let's drop these utopian eco agendas that are to the detriment of ordinary people and lunacy. That's the editorial of the Daily Telegraph. The Financial Times, slightly more considered actually, Tories urge Sunak to rein in green pledges after election carnage. But their editorial has this interesting line. It says, backing away from green policies is irresponsible for the long-term future, and even if it shores up part of a Conservative base, hopefully it will turn off young voters that the future needs. That's the Financial Times. And just as a kind of ironic bit of fun, the Sun didn't refer to the by-election, but it did have this, summertime of queues, and it's pictures of cars blocking up the roads, which they describe as, what was it, great getaway gridlock. There's not enough room for all these cars. What are we going to do about it? What an irony. And just in case you thought it was just one flavour of policies, The Guardian, Starmer now faces dilemma over green policies, urging both the Conservatives and the Labour Party, which I declare an interest as I still a member, to rethink their green policies because they won't win elections. And if you just think it's the newspapers, remember that the newspapers set the media bulletins in the newsrooms of the televisions and the radio studios. They have a board and then write down the headlines and follow them. I got up early this morning and looked at Sky News and the BBC News. The lesson from the by-election, said the commentators, is both Labour and Tories must rethink policies. They need both to pull back on green policies and climate change targets. The UK, the Uxbridge by-election is now seen as a successful referendum on the way to win elections. Drop the zero emissions and green policies and greening the economy because it's not popular. Anyone that heard the Radio 5, heard some glimpses of a Radio 5 phoning programme on a morning with Nikki Campbell, people ringing in there, the anger, it's my car. The government issued this afternoon the need to weaponise anti-green strategies as wedge issues, as they do in America, to divide the electorate. So anyone under the illusion that we're winning the climate crisis argument for radical action perhaps needs to pause under this kind of assault. Crude political populism did not disappear with UKIP. It's still within our politics. Green politics and policies are now being tuned up into issues to generate fear, conflict and division, to maintain the power, advantage and state of quo of those in whose interest it is to keep an anti-green and an anti-planet economy going. And the appeal now is to individual fear of the threatened self-interest. My personal right to drive, my personal survival, is more important and against the common good, that key word. In other words, there's a fundamental undermining of the common good, which, with the dignity of the person, is at the heart of our social teaching. As one person put it on the media this morning, beware, because you're personally being asked to pay for it. We shouldn't be asked to make self-sacrifices for the planet. We need to be personally committed. Where does that leave? And there's a line in one of the papers which says, in one of the letters in the papers, the prophetic Live Simply campaign of CAFOD is a waste of time and should be abandoned as useless. In my neighbourhood, I would have to say to you, to mention net zero, 1.5 degrees, decarbonisation, isn't the language in which to communicate the need for action around this crisis. I say that in the light of those that may remember a certain campaign called the Remain campaign, and that belief that the facts will persuade people all by themselves. Statistical analysis and science might not win through against very organised and powerful lobbying. And I use that word very deliberately. Lobbying is not advocacy. And I want to speak about advocacy. So how do we respond to these signs of the times of the political culture? Two books. One of them's referred to in your notes for resources for this conference. But the other one isn't yet. One is, of course, you'll know, Laudato Si, Care for Our Common Home and Care for the Poor. And the other one is Pope Francis's latest encyclical, which you'll know as well as I, Fratelli Tutti on Social Friendship. That's about interpersonal, relational building, listening to people, making sure that politics is in touch with the realities of the people, starting with the poor. And what I want to suggest to you is that we bind these two volumes together and use them as our workbook all the time. Don't go for one and not the other. And why do I say that? Because at present, we face the division again, care for the earth being divided against care for the poor, as it was before. The talk is starting to divide between those that are poor and those that want to look after the environment and, quote, can afford to do so. Both that kind of talk actually masks the real transformation that's taking place and has taken place, which I would describe as polluting economies that have been killing the poor. And we have to hold these together. There was a pamphlet published by our own bishops, Catholic Bishops' Conference, in 1972, that kind of fell off my shelf the other day. It's called From Charity to Empowerment, the Church's Mission Alongside Poor and Marginal People. And I think I'm going to campaign for it to be reprinted, because it suggests that what we can do is three things, and it spells them out as charity, welfare charity, it calls it, advocacy, and empowerment. Charity, welfare action. I would highlight the action in history of the SVP, for example, that we know well. Yes, visiting people, supporting people and families, food banking, carrying the church into the wider community, as no one else did during COVID, for which there was some recognition for the Catholic Church. Empowerment, you heard Christine Allen this morning. I think CAFOD internationally embodies models of empowering people to rebuild communities and build a voice for themselves in their own communities and neighbourhoods. But I think the one neglected concept, the one neglected theme of Action for Justice, is advocacy. It gets a bit squeezed out of Catholic social teaching. I remember some years ago when I was in Parliament, reading, I think I read this piece in the paper by an American commentator called P.J. O'Rourke. He was a cultural critic. And he turned around, he was asked, what are politicians for? And he said, oh, it's easy, survival. And so can you spell it out a bit more? He said, yes, all they're interested in is sustaining an image of competence from one day to the next. Noticed its image of competence, not the reality. And it's incredibly short term, writ large. I heard that remark a bit later. I was a minister at the time. And I thought one day to the next was long-term thinking, because I got up in the morning and listened to Radio 4. I might have even been on it. And I thought, have I got through that news bulletin without being dragged down? Then I get down to the lunchtime news and there's something happening there in the department. So I can survive the lunchtime news. Downhill to the 5 o'clock today programme. Then I'm heading to the 6 o'clock news. Then it's news night and I've got into bed and I'm still alive and I haven't been sacked as a minister. I thought it was, in other words, the short-termism of decisions and thinking is incredible. And what it does is it eclipses any sense of long-term vision and strategy. And what it does is it reduces politics to performance, not principle and policies. It becomes, as one person put it in the 60s, society a spectacle. It becomes personal. And it's about not lived experience, but a kind of disconnected representation, as someone once put it. It's all about image. As long as the people are seeing me in a crowded marketplace on television, I'll survive. It doesn't really matter what I do or what a vision or what values I've got. And the danger is that policy, that politics has been reduced to that. And it's also been personalised again in the last couple of days. It's about, as someone said, it's about the tactics of survival, and the next election will definitely be presidential between Mr. Sunak and Mr. Starmer. Well, I have to say, I hope we don't reduce our politics to that. And it's that presentational approach to the politics of survival that fundamentally undermines any belief in the possibilities of significant change. It goes hand in hand with a fundamental loss of real, deep, sustained hope. It leads to a view of the world that's often condemnatory of others and simply political survival pragmatism. And it slips into cynicism, the word weaponization of issues, for example. It slips into resignation and despair. And the people believing that nothing can really be changed. And I just was left wondering, that word activism, can we regard it as one of the virtues? Does the gospel encourage and promote activism? Because I think I'm hearing activism now mentioned as some kind of new term of abuse. Radio 4 introduced a speaker the other day as rumoured to be an activist, as if they were a kind of proto-criminal. And the problem is, and given the new Public Order Act, they probably will be a proto-criminal before long, because the problem is that this culture of politics is presented increasingly as in-house Westminster. It's increasingly presented as a leader's game, and policies are reduced to simplistic slogans. And democracy is treated as if it begins and ends in the polling booth. And it's restricting politics to a one-off vote. That wasn't my lived experience of politics or why I was in politics. Mr. Lee Anderson, if I may quote him, deputy chair of the Conservative Party, even suggested, people should keep out of daily politics, he said. He said this, you have the right to vote. Why do you need the right to protest, to strike and to speak freely? And what's happening is those in power are seeking to restrain the full democratic process, to clamp down on protest. My earliest experience of politics came from campaigning. It was in the streets of Wellclose Mountain, Leeds, where there was a massive row going on between the condition of the housing of the people we lived among and the way we were being treated by landlords and the council. And we were after repairs. So what we did with the mums and tots, we organised a protest, and we blocked the main roads with prams going backwards and forwards all day so they couldn't get into town. I'll tell you now, if you went out with a pram and blocked a road, you'd be locked up under the new Public Order Act. That's the problem. The suppression, the normalisation of criminalisation of protest. And for young people, they're going to be getting lifelong criminal records that they find hard to cross off, to put fear into their hearts, not to challenge the system. So it's okay to complain or moan in a phone-in or Twitter about the state of things, but it's not okay to actually challenge it. And even within the church, there was a letter in the tablet from a priest opposing trade union strikes. I seem to think within our Catholic teaching tradition, right back to Rerum Novarum and before, there was support for workers to organise together to demand their rights. The letter in the tablet from the priest opposing the strike said, "We should oppose the strikes because it follows the steps of Marx, and that's not the same as following the steps of Jesus Christ." It would be interesting to point out of him that trade unions and strikes were there before Karl Marx, but not to worry, there's just a bit of historical gap there. But on the other hand, you can see where the tone is. Keep out of politics. Sheldon Wallin, in a book called Politics and Vision, not a Christian to my knowledge, he said this: "The citizen is shrunk to the voter, periodically counted, warned and confused, but otherwise kept at a distance from actual decision-making and allowed occasionally to put in a cameo appearance according to a script crafted and composed by the real opinion makers." How familiar does that feel? That's the challenge. Even social justice as a concept is under attack. In America, it's referred to, you know, we would be referred to as social justice warriors, disparagingly. Hooray. They echo the philosopher Hayek, who's behind a lot of this kind of individualistic, anti-common good thinking. He said, and it's often quoted, "Social justice is meaningless in a modern society, and we should only help people in poverty when it's absolutely necessary." Far, far away from the preferential option for the poor. I'll start there. So let's have a word from Pope Francis. Pope Francis has campaigned passionately to say that, yes, we should take sides with the poor. And what's more, he said that our challenge is not only to take sides with the poor, but actually to make sure they're at the priority of our policies. And he says more than that. He says that in reality, if politics is in this state, what we need to do is to ensure that we don't just go for, as it were, charitable action, but we challenge the laws and the budgets which cause these problems in the first place. We have to get closer to tackling what we might call causes. In Fratelli Tutti, he says, "There's a commanding love expressed in actions of charity that spur people to create more social institutions, give more just regulations and more supportive structures. It follows that it's equally indispensable acts of love to strive to organise and structure society so that one's neighbour will not find him or herself in poverty at all. It's an act of charity to assist someone suffering, but it is also an act of charity in the best sense, if we do not know that person, to work to change the conditions that has caused his or her suffering in the first place." He says the scandal of poverty can't be addressed by providing strategies of containment that only tranquilise the poor and render them tame and inoffensive, reduced to passivity. In other words, the challenge is, as Saint Oscar Romero put it, when the church hears the cry of the oppressed, it cannot but denounce the social structures that give rise to and perpetuate the misery from which that cry arises. In other words, for us, we need a bit of a theological shift in the church and in our own thinking. To shift from charitable action, from Pope Francis's description of the church as a field hospital on the battlefield healing the wounds, to move to challenging the causes. I think it was it Desmond Tutu who put it this way? There comes a point when we need to stop just pulling people out of the river. Think of the floods. We need to go upstream and find out why they are falling in. And that's solidly within the tradition of Catholic social teaching throughout the encyclicals of the last century and a half. Pope Paul VI in Populo Progressio said this: the individual who is animated by true charity labours skillfully to discover the causes of misery and to find the means to combat and overcome it resolutely. And that echoes right through Pope Benedict. He said, the church's public presence is not to be reduced to charitable activities at all, alone. Address causes and address challenging the dominant controlling narrative. So what do we need to be doing? I think activists, and I use that word deliberately and positively, activists need to be communicators and storytellers. We need to be publicly rejecting the so-called balancing of, for example, majority climate scientists with the climate change deniers. We need to be refusing to accept the script and being told it's not about political decisions and political will. We need to refuse to be cowed by conflicts and controversy and deliberate confusion. We need to refuse to be told that we can't propose green measures because it's seen as too costly at present, or spuriously, as in some of the papers say today, because, as they might say, we're on the side of the poor when they've spent decades undermining the poor. Perhaps we also need to refuse to accept the latest narrative, which is that green jobs means losing polluting jobs. You know, that's the latest one. We've got to keep the oil jobs because we need the oil, even though they are polluting. We know they're polluting, but there's no other option. I remember in Leeds in the 60s and 70s, unemployment's rising, and in my neighbourhood, the biggest factory was Kirtsall Forge, and it made wheels for the tank factory in Seacroft. It was the biggest employer in my neighbourhood of about 4,000 people. And some of us, with the campaigns against the arms trade, tried to say, there was a campaign, the Lucas Aerospace, some might remember, can we make good things instead of tanks? Earth-moving machines for development in developing countries. Machines to help people with disabilities to move them out more. Could we use the engineering skills of the people to do life-enhancing developments rather than building tanks? And we went to campaign and we had a slogan about whether war work was the only work possible. And I remember the posters going up around the factory. It's war work or no work. And the people were demoralised. And saying, is that the only option? Similarly, in this debate, why do we see these slogans? Somewhere buried in my memory was a phrase stuck on my wall somewhere that Thomas Aquinas came up with, a wonderful sentence. He said, the art of wisdom is translating the complex and complicated into the naturally clear and simple, but without reducing it to the naively simplistic. Think, take back control, and other such like slogans. The naively simplistic dominating our politics. For those that will remember the great Father Austin Smith, Passionist priest, he warned us, and he said this as church. He said, believing in being all things to all men and women is rooted in a theology that never actually splashes down in the real ocean of human suffering. Where ought we to be? Who ought we to be with? And the need is to be in touch with that ocean, not drowning, but with advocacy. So as well as welfare action and empowering, what's advocacy and what would it look like? Advocacy attempts to understand causes of poverty and injustice and to work on behalf of the poor for changing the structures of justice. So what do we need? We actually need a church that takes risks, not softly whispered backroom lobbying. I'm even tempted to say, even the language of the document, it was a good document that came out some years ago before the general election, and the common good. But when the oil industry talks about the common good and have commandeered the language, It devalues the concept. So it's not enough for our bishops to say, can we support the common good? We have to actually look at the detail. What we need is consistent and sustained advocacy action. Again, Pope Benedict said in Caritas, Deus Caritas Est, the church cannot and must not remain on the sidelines, the building of a better world, or fail to awaken the spiritual energy that can contribute to the betterment of society. In other words, we have to get stuck in advocacy. Advocacy, the word advocacy, an old word, it comes from the Latin ad and vocare, to call together, to call towards. It can also mean to plead the cause of a person. You think of an advocate in court, it's a title that's used there. To intercede, to speak up for another person. And I was just thinking around this word, and when I looked it up in the dictionary, what was interesting, and a few biblical references came up in the Oxford English Dictionary, that perhaps we should explore in our theology a bit further. Christ the advocate, interceding for sinners. The Holy Spirit, commonly referred to as the advocate. And in medieval times, patron saints were advocates. So there's a tradition. What is this advocacy? Who speaks for who? And by advocacy, I just want to emphasise again, I don't mean lobbying, increased professional lobbying that now has to, for example, be registered in a register in the House of Commons where people are paid to go to MPs and committees and state their case on behalf of their interests, just as in the American system. Though I have to say, the American system is more regulated than our British system. So not just lobbying, but how can the church be a catalyst for change? How can it identify and name the scope and scale of the challenge and propose detailed changes? How do we do effective advocacy to change laws and budgets in practice? I'm tempted to say that CSUN are doing a great job at the moment, and they had a great paper on the cost of living crisis, and it ended with a recommendation, rightly, that we should email our MPs. When I was an MP, there wasn't email, but you got a bag of post, and you collected it in the post room of the House of Commons every day, and you would get maybe a couple of hundred letters and correspondence in the post. And I always used to single out the letters that were written to me in hand, because they, I knew, would come from my constituents. You could get everything. For some reason, I got the Concrete Weekly every week, and it just sent through the post. It went in a reason. But you could get everything. But you had to select out who are the people you represent and want to work with. Now, with emails, my successor in Parliament in West Leeds is Rachel Reeves. She gets 3,000 emails a day. What happens? She has to employ people to sift them because there's not a place on the email. They come from China, America. They come from Russia. They come from the whole world, about everything. And I remember once getting a letter saying, John Battle, we're never going to vote for you again because you haven't done enough to support the donkey park. And I thought, there isn't a donkey park in West Leeds. I know every inch of the place. And I thought, I've slipped up somewhere. I have to fight for every vote. Where's the donkey park? The letter had come from Plymouth. And that's the problem with emails. The Rachel Reeves and other MPs are spending time paying people, their staff, to sift through emails to say, write back to them, say, send me your postcode and address so that I can see I represent you. And that takes time, by which time the person might have moved away by the time they sifted through all that lot. So the communication with MPs is not what it was. I would just say to you, I personally now, if I want to communicate with an MP formally, I write a personal letter and do it in my own hand, because I know that goes through a slow mail system, but I know it gets there and might be read by the person because they might see a handful of letters as opposed to 3,000 emails. I don't want to decry approaching MPs. I'll say a bit about that. But we need a strategy. There was a lovely line that Pope Benedict came out with, and he said, love, and his Caritas encyclical, love needs to be organised to be of useful benefit to the community. We have to organise, and that includes us in NJP. We need a strategy. But we also need to do research to do advocacy. We need to know what we think needs to be changed. We need to ask the question, where does the change need to take place? Think of, yes, solidarity, but subsidiarity. Where are the decisions really made? Can we actually do what we might call a power analysis to ask in the first place, who does have the power? And the power might not only be with governments, ministers, MPs and Whitehall. In my neighbourhood, we did a power analysis. We came up with the regional mayor now, the local authorities, the council, the health authorities, the business organisations in the community, even consortia in our neighbourhood of NGOs in the third sector, as well as MPs and councillors. And when we've done the power analysis to know who's where, what about target and focus with very specific acts? And I know that, for example, CSAN made very clear demands for the two-child policy, for example, that, again, is going to be difficult to push forward, but has made a very clear ask. And the other thing to do is not to be left alone. I know Anne writes regularly to MPs and presses power, but we need to get behind her. And we need to do it in gangs and groups and parishes and great and as organisations with names behind it to show that we have people power behind us. We need to build relationships. I'll give an example. I'm involved in the Citizens UK movement in Leeds as well, and with Citizens in Leeds. And we discovered that we had listening sessions, and we discovered that the biggest need in our neighbourhoods, this is just a few years ago, pre-COVID, was mental health services for the young and the old, because they weren't there with it. So we said, well, who decides it? Do we write to the health minister? No, we've got the primary care and the commissioning boards. We tried to seek out, do the analysis about whom has the money to put into our doctors, surgeries and clinics money for the mental health services that we need. So we've got a clear ask. We want mental health services in every surgery in inner city Leeds. So we asked them to meet us as citizens. Occasionally these public health bodies had meetings where they tried to report back to the people with a public meeting. And I used to go as an MP, and there'd be three people there, and a host of doctors and administrators, and they gave an annual report and then went home. And you had 10 minutes if you wanted to ask a question. So we thought, right, your next one will turn up. So they said, it's going to be in Meanwood, which was close enough, at a church hall. How many people are you bringing? I said, well, about 50. Oh, we've only got chairs for 10. because nobody normally comes. Well, we're coming. And then the meeting was to take place on the Wednesday. On the Friday, they changed the place of the meeting from inner city Leeds to Wetherby, which is miles away. So what did we do? We organised buses, cars, and we took 120 people to their meeting. And when we got there, it wasn't with banners and a confrontation. We said to them, we're coming in, and you've a 15-minute slot, and we have one of our friends who's with us, who lost his son to suicide and got no support. And he's going to tell you his experience for 15 minutes, and you're going to listen, then we're going to give you our ask. So he gave his story. And they were shocked, and they thought we were going to say, can you give us the money? And I said, no. Our ask is, you've heard the story. We want you to go home and reflect on it. Then we want you to meet and reflect on it. And then in 6 weeks' time, 10 of us are coming back to meet with you to ask what you're going to do about it. They ummed and ahed. They wouldn't meet us for a few weeks. They'd forgotten we'd arranged to meet them. But we got £13 million in the end for the surgeries across the whole of Leeds for mental health. And it was because we focused, we targeted, not confrontational. We built a longer-term relationship. The citizens' movement is helpful, those of you know, listening to the needs of the people, one-to-one conversations not done on the internet, coming together with a clear demand, building relationships with people with power to make clear asks. I want to suggest to you that now's the time to move on politics, because an election period is coming up, and the political parties will be writing their manifestos, their new ideas. So now's the time to make some suggestions. And can I say to you that don't just think of MPs, don't ignore MPs and candidates, but think of their workers, think of their researchers, think who will be writing the ideas to pull together for these manifestos. Think of their constituency officers. Make contacts with them, perhaps we should do, rather than just send an email into the void. Build relationships. Yes, with candidates maybe, with the coming election in the coming year. And I suggest, a bit like we did with citizens, not to say to them, can I have a one-off meeting and I'd like you to introduce Catholic social teaching and justice, social justice within the first year of your government. Thanks very much, goodbye. No. We're building a relationship with you, so we're going to meet you every 3 months from our parish. when we want to feedback on some key themes. What are you doing on international development and the cut to overseas aid and spending it all on asylum seekers? What are you doing about the processes for people seeking asylum? What are you doing about the green agenda to manage the transition? And following it through and doing it in groups. I like the image of the transparency where we tie down, and I include myself in this in the past, we tie down public representatives a bit like they tied down the character Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels. Do you remember? Thousands of little ropes tied him to the floor and little people all around him. That's the image. Can we tie them down? But at the same time to suggest in our programme, there's a lovely booklet, in the booklet, a lovely list of alliances, and they're in the hall in the fair. But we need to build wider alliances and outside the church. And the time now is to do it. The bishops have built a tremendous reputation for us campaigning on the whole issue of refugees, the Love the Stranger pamphlet that's out. But we've a track record as church of arguing and stating the case for people who are refugees. Let's transform that, and the support comes in then from bodies that are not within our church and wider. We need to do the same across the whole of the agenda of sustainability and poverty. In other words, we need to expand the definition of democratic action beyond electoral politics of polling booths and open up new spaces for participatory democracy that's practiced with real deliberation and discernment in our communities and neighbourhoods. Raymond Williams made the comment once, he said, to be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. And I think that's the challenge. I'll give a final example and then perhaps just close. In our Justice and Peace group some 15 years ago, became aware of the treatment of women asylum seekers who had no children. And if you remember, and now they have no recourse to public funds. So the council can't help them. They can't get money from anywhere. Where did they end up? On the street. So we went to the diocese, and at first we asked Catholic Care, could they help us with any of their premises they weren't using, and we had a place there for a while. But then they needed the building back. So we went, a team of us, about 10 years ago, and said to the bishop, well, the church is shrinking, parishes are joining together. Where are the presbyteries you're not using? Can we have them? And we have done. We've just finished completing St Monica. It's called St Monica's Trust, and we've just completed our third house, which is actually my own parish, where seven women moved in just after Easter. And they get all their support from the neighbourhood. It's in one of the poorest neighbourhoods, where the people support them daily with their daily needs, money, rent, and they pay a bit of rent, the rest of it. And then for 6 months, they're with us, and we try to get their MP to sort their papers out, because they're people waiting for a decision. That's what it's about. And in the meantime, we get a letter from the charity commissioners. First they wrote to me, because I chair it, saying, did I realise that I was against the Equal Opportunities Act because these houses were only for women and not for men? So I write back to the charity commissioners and say, well, I don't know many domestic violence refugees that are mixed, but there you go, perhaps you'd inform me. And then we got a note recently saying, we hope you are not joining in the campaign against the illegal migration bill, because this will be against your charitable objects by campaigning. And this could jeopardise your, wait for it, your gift aid status in your church as a charity. Watch that space. And that's why I quoted, as a church, we need to take risks, we need to be courageous, and we may need to pay a price as well. And Monica's will go from strength to strength, and not least supported by the bishop. And people are campaigning against restrictive regulations coming from charity commissioners and electoral law commissions and the rest of it to try and restrict us having a voice in the general election. Expand that definition of democratic action. And finally, if I may, I'd like perhaps to quote just a comment on hope. It's a little pamphlet. I'm into republishing pamphlets. I spoke about that one. My other pamphlet that I brought from my little back catalogue, if you like, in the box, Herbert McCabe, the Dominican, you may know of him, real theological campaigner. He wrote a book called Hope. And I'll just close with this passage on hope. We are not optimists, We do not present a lovely vision of the world which everyone is expected to fall in love with. We simply have, wherever we are, with some local tasks to do on the side of the poor. This, in the power of the Spirit, we will try to do. And we know that to do it is to risk hostility and persecution as Jesus risked crucifixion. It is to risk defeat. And that's what we mean by hope. For our hope is the kind that goes through defeat and crucifixion to resurrection. We know that we shall sometimes have to fail rather than betray the very justice we struggle for. We shall have to fail rather than use the weapons of the oppressor against him. But we can do this because we have hope. Because we know that God will bring life out of such defeat and failure as he brought life out of the tomb of Jesus. Thank you for listening.